mind some kind of ultimate goal. The meaning was in the process, to break down the most food possible, convert it even faster, and eliminate the dregs. Everything that was left of smoking pork chops, juicy braised mushrooms, fluffy cakes, now rotten and contaminated. Personality traits began to fade, becoming impersonal mechanisms for the destruction of the beautiful and the useful, creating instead something putrid and worthless. Artyom was disgusted with people and felt no less aversion to them than they to him. Mark was stoically patient and tried to cheer up Artyom from time to time by saying things like, "Don't worry about it, they told me beforehand that emigration is always difficult at the beginning." And the main thing was that neither on the first nor the second day did any possibility of escape present itself. The security guards were vigilant, and although the only thing Artyom and Mark would have to do to escape was to enter the tunnel beyond the shaft, heading toward Dobryninskaya, that was simply impossible. They spent the night in a nearby closet. The door was locked carefully at night, and whatever the time of day, the guard sat at the glass booth by the entrance to the station. The third day of their stay at the station arrived. Time here did not pass according to the usual 24-hour day. It crawled along like a slug, in the seconds of an unending nightmare. Artyom had already grown accustomed to the idea that nobody would ever approach him and talk to him again, and that the fate of a pariah was in store for him. It was as though he were no longer human, and had turned into an inconceivably monstrous being, whom people saw not just as something ugly and repulsive, but also somehow perceptibly related to themselves. And that scared them and repulsed them even more, as if they might catch this monstrousness from him, as if he were a leper. First he worked out an escape plan, then came a resounding void of despair. After that, a dull stupor took over in which his intellect was disconnected from his life. He turned inward, drew in the threads of feeling and sensation, and went into a cocoon somewhere in a remote corner of consciousness. Artyom continued to work mechanically, his motions as precise as those of an automaton. All he had to do was dig, dump, roll, and dig again, roll again, drain, and go back the other way, faster to start digging again. His dreams lost any meaning. And in them, just as in his waking hours, he endlessly ran, dug, pushed, pushed, dug, and ran. On the evening of the fifth day, Artyom, pushing the wheelbarrow, tripped over a shovel that had been left on the floor. The wheelbarrow overturned, the contents spilled, and then he fell down into it himself. When he arose slowly from the floor, an idea suddenly popped into his head. And instead of running for a bucket and cloth, he slowly and deliberately headed for the entrance to the tunnel. He himself could feel that he was now so loathsome, so repulsive, that his aura would have to drive anyone away. And just at the moment, due to an improbable confluence of circumstances, the security guard, who was invariably hanging around at the end of his route, was, for some reason, not there. Without giving a moment's thought to whether someone might be chasing him, Artyom started off across the ties. Blinded but hardly stumbling, he walked faster and faster until breaking into a run. But his reason had not returned to the job of directing his body. It was still holed up, cowering in its corner. Behind him he heard no shouts, no footsteps of pursuers, only the trolley clattered by, loaded with cargo, and lighting its way with a dim lantern. Artyom simply pressed himself against the wall, letting it go past. The people on board either did not notice him or did not consider it necessary to pay him any attention. Their gazes passed over him without lingering, and they didn't say a word. Suddenly he was seized with a feeling of his own invulnerability conferred on him by his fall. Covered with stinking sludge, it was as if he had become invisible. This gave him strength, and consciousness gradually began to return. He had done it. Who knew how, against all good sense, despite everything, he had managed to escape from the accursed station, and nobody was even following him. It was strange, it was amazing, but it seemed to him that if he were only to try right now to comprehend what had happened, to dissect the miracle with the cold scalpel of rationality, then the magic would dissipate immediately, and the beam of the searchlight from a patrol trolley would quickly strike him in the back. Light shone at the end of the tunnel. He slackened his pace, and after a minute, he was at Dobryninskaya. The border guard there satisfied himself with the simple question, "Did they call for a sanitary technician?" and quickly let him through, waving away the air around himself with one hand while holding the other over his mouth. Artyom had to keep moving to get out of Hansa territory fast before the security guards finally gathered their wits, before he could hear behind him the tramp of iron-rimmed jackboots, before warning shots thundered out into the air, and then... faster. Not looking at anyone, keeping his eyes to the floor, his skin crawling with the disgust those around him felt for him, a vacuum forming around him, so that he did not have to elbow his way through the dense crowd, Artyom strode to the border post. And now what was he going to say? More questions, more demands to present his passport. How could he reply? Artyom's head hung so low that his chin touched his chest, and he saw absolutely nothing around him, so that the only things he remembered about the whole station were the dark, neatly arranged granite slabs on the floor. He kept walking, frozen with anticipation of the moment when he would hear the peremptory order to stand still. Hansa's border was closer and closer. Now. Right now.
"What kind of rubbish is this?"
a gasping voice resounded in his ear. There it was.
I got lost. I am not from here,
muttered Artyom, tongue-tied with nervousness or maybe just getting into his role.
"Well, get the hell out of here, do you hear, you ugly mug?"
The voice sounded very persuasive, almost hypnotic, making him want to obey right away.
"Sure, I would,"
mumbled Artyom, afraid, not knowing how to get out of this one.
"Begging is strictly forbidden in Hansa territory,"
the voice said sternly, and this time it was from a greater distance.
"Of course, right away, I have little children."
Artyom finally realized what button to press and became more animated.
"What children? Are you nuts?"
The invisible border guard flew into a range.
"Popov! Lomako! Come here! Get this scumbag out of here!"
Neither Popov nor Lomako wanted to soil their hands by touching Artyom, so they just shoved him in the back with the barrels of their automatics. Their superiors' angry curses flew after them. To Artyom, this sounded like heavenly music. Serpukhovskaya Station. He had left the Hansa behind. Finally, he looked up, but what he saw in the eyes of the people surrounding him made him look back at the floor. This was not tidy, Hansan territory. He was once again in the midst of the dirty, poverty-stricken bedlam that reigned throughout the rest of the metro, but even here, Artyom was too loathsome. The miraculous armor that had saved him along the way, making him invisible, forcing people to turn away from the fugitive and not to notice him, to let him through all the outposts and checkpoints, had now turned back into a stinking, shitty scab. Evidently, it was already past noon. Now that the initial exultation had worn off, that strange strength, as if borrowed from someone else, which had forced him to keep walking across the stretch from Paveletskaya to Dobryninskaya, abruptly disappeared and left him alone with himself, hungry, deathly tired, without a penny to his name, giving off an unbearable stench, still showing traces of the blows of the week before. The paupers next to whom he had sat down along the wall decided that they could no longer abide such company, crawled away from him, cursing in various directions, and he was left completely alone. Hugging his shoulders so as not to feel so cold, he closed his eyes and sat there for a long while, thinking about absolutely nothing, until sleep overcame him. Artyom was walking along an unfinished tunnel. It was longer than all those he had traversed throughout his whole life rolled into one. The tunnel twisted and turned, sometimes ascending, sometimes descending, but was never straight for more than 10 paces. But it just went on, and walking became harder and harder. His feet, blistered and bloody, were hurting. His back ached. Each new step called forth an echo of pain throughout his body. But as long as hope remained that the exit was not far away, maybe just around that next corner, Artyom found the strength to keep going. But then suddenly the simple but terrifying thought occurred to him. What if the tunnel had no exit? If both the entrance and exit were closed, if someone invisible and omnipotent had shut him off, left him thrashing around like a rat unsuccessfully trying to reach the experimenter's finger in this maze without exit, so that he would keep dragging himself along until he gave out, until he collapsed, and doing this for no reason, just for fun, a rat in a maze, a squirrel in a wheel. But then he thought, if continuing along the road does not lead to the exit, will refusing any senseless forward motion perhaps bestow liberation? He sat down on the railway tie, not because he was tired, but because he was at the end of his rope. The walls around him disappeared, and he thought, in order to achieve the goal, to complete the journey, all I have to do is to stop walking. Then this thought faded away and disappeared. When he woke up, he was seized by overwhelming anxiety, and at first could not imagine what had caused it. Only later did he begin to recall bits of the dream, to piece together a mosaic from these fragments. But the fragments just would not hold together. They crumbled. There was not enough glue to hold them together. That glue was some idea that had come to him during his dream. It was pivotal, a vision from the heart, and very important to him. Without it, all that was left was a pile of ragged underwear, but with it, a wonderful picture full of miraculous import, opening up limitless horizons. But he couldn't remember the idea. Artyom gnawed on his fists, seized his dirty head with his dirty hands, his lips whispered something incomprehensible, and passers-by looked at him with fear and aversion. But the idea just didn't want to return. Then slowly, carefully, as if trying to use a strand of hair to pull out something stuck in a swamp, he started to reconstruct the idea out of the fragments of memory. And what a miracle! Deftly grabbing hold of one of the images, he suddenly recognized it, in the same primordial form that it had first announced itself in his dream. To finish the journey, he only needed to stop walking. But now, in the bright light of waking consciousness, the thought seemed to him banal, pitiful, unworthy of attention. To finish the journey, he needed to stop walking. Well, of course, if you stop walking, then your journey is over. What could be simpler? But is that really the way out? And could that really be the conclusion of the journey? It often happens that an idea that appears in a dream to be a stroke of genius turns out to be a meaningless jumble of words when one wakes up.
Oh, my beloved brother, filth on your body and in your soul.
The voice was right next to him. That was as unexpected as the return of the idea, and the bitter taste of that disillusionment instantly vanished. He didn't even think the voice was addressing him, since he had already become so accustomed to the idea that people fled in all directions, even before he could utter a word.
We welcome all the orphaned and wretched,
the voice continued. It sounded so soft, so reassuring, so tender, that Artyom, no longer restraining himself, cast a sideways glance to the left, and then gloomily glanced to the right, afraid to discover that the person speaking was actually addressing somebody else. But there was nobody else nearby. The person was talking to him. Then he slowly raised his head and met the eyes of a rather short, smiling man, wearing a loose-fitting robe, with dark blonde hair and rosy cheeks, who was reaching out his hand in friendship. It was vital for Artyom to reciprocate, so not daring to smile, he too extended his hand. Why isn't he recoiling from me like everybody else, thought Artyom. He's even ready to shake my hand. Why did he come up to me on his own, when everyone around was trying to get as far away from me as possible?
I will help you, my brother,
the rosy-cheeked fellow continued.
The brothers and I will give you shelter and restore your spiritual strength.
Artyom just nodded, but his new companion found that sufficient.
So allow me to take you to the watchtower, oh, my beloved brother,
he intoned, and firmly taking Artyom by the hand, drew him along. Artyom did not remember much, and certainly didn't remember the road, but only understood that he was being led from the station into a tunnel, but which of the four he did not know. His new acquaintance introduced himself as Brother Timothy. On the road, and at the grey, mundane Serpukhovskaya station, and in the dark tunnel, he never stopped talking.
Rejoice, O beloved brother of mine, that you met me on your way, for your life is about to undergo a momentous change. The cheerless gloom of your aimless wandering is at an end, because you will attain that which you seek.
Artyom did not understand very well what the man had in mind, because for him personally, his wanderings were far from over. But the rosy-cheeked and gentle Timothy spoke so smoothly and tenderly that he just wanted to keep on listening, to communicate with him in the same language, grateful for not rejecting him when the whole world rejected him.
Do you believe in the one true God, O brother Artyom?
Timothy inquired, as if, by the way, looking Artyom attentively in the eyes. Artyom could only shake his head in an indefinite way and mumble something unintelligible, which could be interpreted as desired, either as agreement or rejection.
That's good. That's wonderful, Brother Artyom,
Timothy exclaimed.
Only belief in the truth will save you from the torments of eternal hell and grant you expiation of your sins, because,
he assumed a stern and triumphal expression,
the kingdom of the God of our Jehovah is coming, and the holy biblical prophecies will be fulfilled. Do you study the Bible, O brother?
Artyom mumbled again, and the rosy-cheeked fellow this time looked at him with some misgivings.
When we get to the watchtower, your own eyes will convince you that you must study the holy book, given to us from on high, and the great blessings will come to those who have turned to the path of truth. The Bible, a precious gift of the God of our Jehovah, can only be compared to a letter from a loving father to his young son,
Brother Timothy added for good measure.
Do you know who wrote the Bible?
He asked Artyom a bit sternly. Chapter 11. I don't believe it. Artyom decided that there was no sense in pretending anymore, and honestly shook his head.
At the watchtower, they will lead you to this and to much more, and your eyes will be open to many things,
proclaimed Brother Timothy.
Do you know what Jesus Christ, the Son of God, said to his disciples at Laodicea?
Seeing Artyom avert his eyes, he shook his head in mild reproach.
Jesus said, I counsel you to buy from me salve, to anoint your eyes, that you may see. But Jesus was not talking about physical illness,
stressed Brother Timothy, raising his index finger, and his voice shifted to an exalted, intriguing intonation that promised to the inquiring mind an astonishing sequel. Artyom was quick to express lively interest.
Jesus was talking about spiritual blindness, which had to be healed,
said Timothy in explanation of the riddle.
Like you and thousands of other lost souls who are wandering blindly in the dark. But belief in the true God of our Jehovah is that salve for the eyes which opens your eyelids wide, so that you can see the world as it really is. Because you can see physically, but spiritually you are blind.
Artyom thought that eye ointment would have done him good 4 days ago. Since he didn't reply, Brother Timothy decided that this complex idea required some further interpretation, and was quiet for a while to allow what Artyom had heard to sink in. But after 5 minutes, a light flickered up ahead, and Brother Timothy interrupted his reflections to report the joyous news.
Do you see the light in the distance? That is the watchtower. We are here.
There was no tower at all, and Artyom felt slightly disappointed. It was a regular train standing in a tunnel, whose headlights shone softly in the darkness, illuminating 15 meters in front of it. When Brother Timothy and Artyom arrived at the train, a chubby man came down from the engineer's cab to meet them, wearing the same type of robe as Brother Timothy. He embraced Rosy Cheeks and also called him my beloved brother, from which Artyom deduced that this was more a figure of speech than a declaration of love.
Who is this young fellow?
The chubby guy asked in a low voice, smiling tenderly at Artyom.
Artyom, our new brother, who wants to walk with us on the path to truth, to study the Holy Bible and to renounce the devil,
explained rosy-cheeked Timothy.
Then permit the watchtower to welcome you, O my beloved brother Artyom,
droned Fatso. And Artyom was again amazed that he did not seem to notice the unbearable stench that had now permeated his entire being.
And now, cooed Brother Timothy as they were making their leisurely way through the first car, before you meet the brothers in the hall of the kingdom, you have to clean your body, for Jehovah God is clean and holy, and expects his worshippers to maintain their spiritual, moral, and physical cleanliness, as well as cleanliness of thoughts. We live in an unclean world,
he said, glancing sadly at Artyom's clothes, which were certainly in a deplorable condition.
And serious efforts are required of us to remain clean in God's eyes, my brother,
he concluded, and hustled Artyom into a nook that was decked out with plastic sheets set up not far from the entrance to the car. Timothy asked him to undress, and then handed him a bar of grey soap with a nauseating smell, and 5 minutes later ran water for him from a rubber hose. Artyom tried not to think about what the soap was made out of. At any event, it not only ate up the dirt on his skin, but also destroyed the disgusting smell emanating from his body. After the procedures were complete, Brother Timothy gave Artyom a relatively fresh robe like his own, and looked disapprovingly at the cartridge case hanging around his neck, perceiving it to be a pagan talisman, but limited himself to a reproachful sigh. It was also surprising that on this strange train, stuck who knows where in the middle of a tunnel, and now serving as a shelter for the brethren, there was water, and it came out under such strong pressure. But when Artyom asked about the strange water that was coming from the hose and how it was possible to build such a structure, Brother Timothy only mysteriously smiled and declared that the aspiration to please Lord Jehovah really moved people to heroic and glorious acts. The explanation was more than a bit foggy, but it would have to suffice. Then they went into the second wagon where long empty tables were built between rigid lateral benches. Brother Timothy walked up to a man who was conjuring something over a big cauldron from which a seductive steam was rising, and he returned with a big dish of some kind of thin gruel, which turned out to be quite edible, even though Artyom couldn't work out what it was made from. While he hastily scooped up the hot soup with an old aluminium spoon, Brother Timothy watched affectionately, not missing a chance to proselytize. "Don't think that I don't trust you, brother, but your answer to my question about belief in our God didn't sound very solid. Can you really imagine a world in which he doesn't exist? Surely our world can't have created itself, not according to his wise will. Could the infinite variety of forms of life, the beauty of the earth," he gestured around the dining room with his beard, "could all this be just an accident?" Artyom looked around the wagon attentively, but didn't see any other forms of life in it apart from themselves and the cook. Again he bent over his bowl and only issued some skeptical rumblings. Contrary to his expectations, his disagreement didn't embitter Brother Timothy at all, quite the opposite, in fact. He had visibly enlivened. His pink cheeks were lit with a fervent fighting flush. "If this doesn't convince you of his existence," Brother Timothy continued energetically, "then think about it in a different way. If this world isn't a display of divine will, then it means..." His voice froze as if from fright, and only after several long moments during which Artyom completely lost his appetite did he finish his thought. "Then that means that people are left to their own devices, and there's no point to our existence, and there's no point in prolonging it. It means that we are completely alone, and no one cares for us. It means that we are plunged into chaos, and there isn't the slightest hope of a light at the end of the tunnel. And it's frightening to live in such a world. It's impossible to live in such a world." Artyom didn't say anything to him in reply, but these words made him think. Until this moment he had in fact viewed his life as total chaos, like a chain of accidents without connection or sense. Though this oppressed him, and the temptation to trust any simple truth that might fill his life with meaning was great, he considered it cowardice, and through the pain and the doubt he gained strength in the thought that his life was of no use, and that each living thing should resist nonsense and the chaos of life. But he didn't feel at all like arguing with the gentle Timothy right now. He felt a satisfied and benevolent feeling, and he felt sincere gratitude to the person who had picked him up, tired, hungry, and stinking, and who had spoken warmly to him, who now fed him and had given him clean clothes. He wanted to somehow thank him, and so when the man beckoned him to join a meeting of brothers, Artyom stood up readily, showing with his every mannerism that he would go with pleasure to this meeting and wherever he was led. The meeting was to take place in the next, that is, the third carriage. It was full of all sorts of people, mostly dressed in the same overalls. In the middle of the carriage there was a small scaffold, and the person standing on it towered over everybody at floor level, almost resting his head on the ceiling. "It's important that you listen to everything," Brother Timothy told Artyom instructively, clearing their path with gentle nudges and leading Artyom to the very middle of the crowd. The orator was rather old, and there was a handsome grey beard falling down his chest, and his deep-set eyes of an indeterminate colour looked down wisely and calmly. His face wasn't thin or round, it was furrowed with deep wrinkles, but it didn't portray an old man's weakness or helplessness, but rather a wisdom. It radiated an inexplicable force.
"That's Elder John," Brother Timothy whispered to Artyom in a reverential voice. "You are really lucky, Brother Artyom. As soon as the sermon begins, you will receive teachings at once."
The elder raised his hand. The rustlings and whisperings stopped immediately. Then he began in a deep and sonorous voice.
"My first lesson to you, my beloved brothers, is about how to know what God is asking of you. To do this, you must answer three questions. What important information is contained in the Bible? Who is its author? Why should we study it?"
His speech differed from Brother Timothy's meandering manner. He spoke absolutely simply, plainly navigating short propositions. Artyom was at first surprised by this, but then he looked from side to side and saw that the majority of people there were only able to understand words like this, and the pink-cheeked Timothy had no more effect on them than the walls or the table. Meanwhile, the grey-haired preacher informed them that God's truth lay in the Bible, who he is and which were his laws. After that, he turned to the second question and told them that the Bible was written by about 40 different people over 1,600 years, and they were all inspired by God.
"That's why," the elder concluded, "the author of the Bible isn't a person, but it is God, living in the heavens. And now answer me this, brothers. Why do we need to study the Bible?"
And not waiting for the brothers to answer, he explained it himself.
"Because to know God and to do his will is a pledge of your eternal future. Not everyone will be pleased that you are studying the Bible,"
he warned.
"But don't let anyone prevent you."
He cast a stern look around the congregation. There was a moment's silence, and then the old man, having taken a sip of water, continued.
"My second lesson to you, brothers, is about who God is. So give me an answer to these three questions. Who is the true God, and what is his name? What are his most important qualities? What is the right way to worship him?"
Someone from the crowd had wanted to answer one of the questions, but he was thrown furious looks, and John indifferently started to answer the questions himself.
"People worship many things, but in the Bible it says there is only one God. He created everything in heaven and on earth, and since he gave us life, we must worship him alone. What is the name of the true God?"
cried the aged man after a pause.
"Jehovah!"
the crowd burst out with one voice. Artyom looked from side to side warily.
"The true name of God is Jehovah,"
the preacher confirmed.
"He has lots of titles, but one name. Remember the name of our God and don't call him by his titles like a coward, but straight by name. Who will tell me now what is the main quality of our God?"
Artyom thought that he would now see that there was someone vaguely educated in the crowd who could answer such a question. And standing nearby, a serious-looking young man put his hand up to answer, but the old man beat him to it.
"The nature of Jehovah is revealed in the Bible, and his main qualities are love, justice, wisdom, and strength. It is said in the Bible that God is merciful, kind, ready to forgive, magnanimous, and patient. We, like obedient children, should be like him in every way."
What he said caused no objection amongst the congregation, and the aged man, stroking his magnificent beard, asked,
"So tell me, how should we worship our God, Jehovah? Jehovah says that we should only worship him. We must not revere images, pictures, symbols, and pray to them. Our God will not share his glory with someone else. Images are powerless to help us,"
the voice rumbled threateningly. The crowd murmured approvingly, and Brother Timothy turned his joyful, radiant face to Artyom and said,
"Elder John is the great orator, and thanks to him our brotherhood is growing with every day, and the community of followers of the true faith is spreading."
Artyom smiled bitterly. The ardent speech of Elder John did not have the same fiery effect on him as it had on the rest of them, but maybe it was worth listening some more.
"For my third lesson I will tell you about Jesus Christ,"
said the old man.
"And here are three questions. Why is Jesus Christ called the firstborn Son of God? Why did he come to the earth as a person? What would Jesus do in the near future?"
Then it became clear that Jesus was called the firstborn Son of God because he was the first creation of God, an embodiment on earth of the Holy Spirit, and he lived in heaven. Artyom was very surprised by this. He'd only seen the sky once before, on that fateful day at the Botanical Gardens. Someone had once told him that there may be life up there in the stars. Was that what the preacher was talking about? Then Elder John explained,
"But who among you will tell me why Jesus Christ, the Son of God, came to earth?"
And he paused dramatically. Now Artyom had started to realize what was going on around him, and it became clear that those present belonged to the ranks of the converted, and they had been coming to these lectures for some time. Veterans of these lessons never made attempts to answer the elders' questions, whereas the new initiates were trying to show their knowledge and eagerness, crying out answers and waving their hands, but only until the old man explained it all himself.
"When Adam didn't follow God's command, he became the first person to commit what the Bible calls a sin,"
the elder began from afar.
"Therefore God sentenced Adam to death. And gradually Adam grew old and died. But he transferred his sin to his children, and therefore we also get older and become ill and die. And then God sent his firstborn son so he could teach men about God's truth, and in his pure example he showed people an example, and he sacrificed his life to free humankind from sin and death."
This idea seemed very strange to Artyom. Why was it necessary to punish all men with death in order to later sacrifice your only son so that everything would be returned to its original state? How could that be if he was omnipotent?
"Jesus returned to heaven, resurrected. Later God called him King. Soon Jesus will wipe all evil and suffering from the earth,"
the old man promised.
"But we'll speak about this after praying, my brothers."
Obediently inclined heads gathered and joined in the sacrament of prayer. Artyom bathed in the many-voiced buzz from which separate words could not be distinguished, but the general sense made itself clear. After 5 minutes of prayer, the brothers began to exchange words briskly, apparently worrying about the arrival of the Holy Spirit. Something wasn't sitting right with Artyom. He had a nagging feeling, but he decided to stay there for a while because it might be that the most convincing part of the lecture lay ahead.
"And the fourth lesson I will give you is about the devil."
And looking around him with a gloomy and damning look, the elder warned,
"Are you all ready for this? Are you, brother, strong enough in spirit to know about this?"
Then it was absolutely necessary to answer. But Artyom couldn't get a sound out of himself. How could he know if he was sufficiently strong in spirit if he wasn't clear what this was all about anyway?
"And so here are three questions. Where does Satan come from? How does Satan betray people? Why is it necessary for us to resist the devil?"
Artyom let most of the answers to these questions fly past his ears, distracted by the thought of where he was and how he was going to get out of here. He only heard that the main sin of the devil was that he wanted people to worship him, which was a privilege for God alone. And he also wondered if it was really true that God was really concerned with each of his followers, and was there one person who is utterly devoted to God. The language of the aged man now seemed to Artyom frighteningly official and addressed questions that were inappropriate for discussion. From time to time, Brother Timothy looked over at him attentively, searching Artyom's face for the spark of imminent enlightenment. But Artyom was just becoming gloomier and gloomier.
"Satan deceives people, so they will worship him,"
the aged man was saying in the meantime.
"And there are three ways in which he does this: false religion, spiritism, and nationalism. If a religion teaches lies about God, it is serving Satan's purposes. adherents of false religions might easily think that they are worshipping the true God, but in reality they are worshipping Satan. Spiritism is when people call upon spirits to protect them, to harm others, to predict the future, and to perform miracles. Behind each of these actions is the evil force of the devil.
The old man's voice was shaking from hatred and disgust.
And apart from that, Satan deceives people by inciting nationalistic pride within them and inducing them to worship political organizations.
The elder warned them with an upraised finger.
People think that a race or nation is superior to others, but it isn't true.
Artyom rubbed the back of his neck, which was still marred by a red welt, and coughed. He couldn't agree with the last comment.
Some people are convinced that political organizations will get rid of mankind's problems. People who believe that deny the kingdom of God, but only the kingdom of Jehovah will solve the problems of mankind. And now I shall tell you, oh, my brothers, why you must resist the devil. In order to make you repudiate Jehovah, Satan may resort to persecutions and actions against you. Some of your near and dear ones may become angry with you for studying the Bible. Others might start mocking you. But to whom do you owe your life?
Asked the elder, and notes of iron rang out in his voice.
Satan wants to frighten you, so that you'll stop finding out about Jehovah. Don't let him do it. Get the upper hand against Satan.
John's voice crashed like rumbling thunder.
By resisting the devil, you will prove to Jehovah that you are in favor of his dominion.
The crowd roared in ecstasy. With a wave of his hand, Elder John quelled the general hysteria in order to end the meeting with a final fifth lesson.
What did God intend for the earth?
He turned to the audience, spreading his arms.
Jehovah created the earth so that people would live there happily forever. He wanted a righteous and joyful mankind to inhabit the earth. The earth shall never be destroyed. It shall exist for all eternity.
Unable to contain himself, Artyom snorted. Angry looks shot in his direction, and Brother Timothy raised a threatening finger.
The first human beings, Adam and Eve, sinned deliberately violating God's law, continued the orator. Therefore, Jehovah expelled them from paradise, and the paradise was lost. But Jehovah did not forget the purpose for which he had created the earth. He promised to transform it into a paradise in which people would live forever. How did God fulfill his plan?
The elder posed the question to himself. A lengthy pause indicated that the key moment of the sermon was about to arrive. Artyom was all ears.
Before the earth could become a paradise, the evil people would have to be eliminated.
John pronounced the words forebodingly.
It was promised to our forefathers that a cleansing would take place through Armageddon, a divine war for the annihilation of evil, and then Satan would be unfettered for 1,000 years. There would be nobody left to harm the earth. Only God's people would remain alive. And King Jesus Christ will rule the earth for 1,000 years.
The elder turned his burning gaze to the front ranks of the people who were taking in his words.
Do you understand what this means? The divine war for the annihilation of evil has already ended. What happened to this sinful earth was Armageddon. Evil was incinerated. According to what was prophesied, only God's people would survive. We who live in the metro are the people of God. We survived Armageddon. The kingdom of God is at hand.
Soon there will be neither old age, nor illness, nor death. The sick shall be freed of their ailments, and the old shall become young again. In the 1,000-year reign of Jesus, the people who are faithful to God shall turn the earth into a paradise, and God shall resurrect millions of the dead.
Artyom recalled Sukhoi's conversation with Hunter about how the level of radiation on the surface would not drop for at least 50 years, and that mankind was doomed and other biological species were on the rise. The elder did not explain exactly how the surface of the earth would turn into a flowering paradise. Artyom wanted to ask him what weird kind of plants were going to bloom in that burned-out paradise, and what kind of people would dare go up above and settle it, and if his parents had been children of Satan, and if that were why they had perished in the war to annihilate evil. But he didn't say anything. He was filled with such bitterness and such mistrust that his eyes burned, and he was ashamed to feel a tear run down his cheek. Mustering his strength, he said just one thing.
Tell me, what does Jehovah, our true God, say about headless mutants?
The question hung in the air. Elder John did not deign even to glance at Artyom, but those standing next to him looked around with fright and repulsion, and they moved away from him as if he had let out a foul smell. Brother Timothy tried to take him by the hand, but Artyom tore away, and pushing aside the brethren who were crowded around, began to make his way to the exit. He made it out of the Hall of the Kingdom and went through the dining carriage. There were a lot of people at the tables now, with empty aluminium bowls in front of them. Something interesting was going on in the middle of the room, and all eyes were turned in that direction.
"Before we partake of this repast, my brethren," a skinny, homely fellow with a crooked nose was saying, "let us listen to little David and his story. This will fill out the sermon we heard today about violence."
He moved aside, his place being taken by a chubby, snub-nosed boy with carefully combed whitish hair.
"He was mad at me and wanted to give me a drubbing,"
David began, speaking with the intonation children use when reciting verses they have learnt by heart.
"Probably only because I was short. I backed away from him and cried out, 'Stop, wait, don't beat me. I haven't done anything to you. What did I do to offend you? You'd better tell me what happened.'"
A well-rehearsed expression of exultation came over David's face.
"And what did that awful bully say to you?"
the skinny fellow jumped in excitedly.
"It turned out that somebody had stolen his breakfast, and he was only taking out his annoyance on the first person he ran into,"
David explained, but something in his voice made it seem doubtful that he himself understood very well what he had just said.
"And what did you do?"
asked the thin man, stoking the tension.
"I just said to him, 'If you beat me, it won't bring your breakfast back,' and I suggested to him instead to go to Brother Chef and tell him what had happened. We asked for another breakfast for him. After that, he shook my hand and was always friendly to me."
"Is the man who offended little David present in this room?"
asked the skinny fellow in the voice of a prosecutor. A hand shot up, and a strapping 20-year-old with a doltish and malevolent-looking face began to make his way toward the improvised stage to tell about the miraculous effect of little David's words upon him. It wasn't easy. The boy was obviously more adept at memorizing words whose meaning he didn't understand. When the presentation was over, and little David and the repentant thug left the stage to the approving sound of applause, the stringy fellow took their place again and addressed the seated audience in an impassioned voice.
"Yes, the words of the meek possess enormous power. As it says in Proverbs, the words of the meek break bones. Softness and meekness are not weakness. Oh, my beloved brethren, for softness conceals an enormous strength of will, and examples from the Holy Bible give us proof."
Flipping through the well-thumbed book for the page he wanted, he began to read aloud some story in tones of rapture. Artyom moved ahead, followed by surprised looks, and finally made it into the lead car. Nobody stopped him there, and he was about to go out onto the tracks, but Bashny, the senior guard, that amiable and unflappable hulk of a man, greeted him cordially at the door, now blocking the way with his torso, and knitting his thick brows, sternly asked if Artyom had permission to exit. There was no way to get around him. Waiting half a minute for an explanation, the guard kneaded his enormous fists with a dry crackle and moved towards Artyom. Looking around in all directions, trapped, Artyom remembered little David's story. Maybe instead of hurling himself against the elephantine guard, it would be worth finding out if maybe somebody stole his breakfast. Fortunately, just then, Brother Timothy caught up with him. Looking at the security man tenderly, he said, "This young man may pass. We don't hold anybody here against their will." The guard, looking at him in surprise, obediently stepped aside. "But allow me to accompany you even just a little way, oh my beloved Brother Artyom," Brother Timothy sang out, and Artyom, unable to resist the magic of his voice, nodded. "Perhaps the way we live here was something unaccustomed for you the first time," Timothy said in soothing tones, "but now the divine seed has been implanted in you as well, and it is clear to my eyes that it has fallen into favored soil. I only want to tell you how you should not act now that the kingdom of God is near as never before, lest you be turned away. You must learn to hate evil and to avoid the things which God abhors, fornication, which means infidelity, sodomy, incest and homosexuality, gambling, lying, thievery, fits of rage, violence, sorcery, spiritualism, drunkenness." Brother Timothy reeled them off in a rush of words, nervously looking Artyom in the eye. "If you love God and wish to please him, free yourself from those sins. Your more mature friends will be able to help you," he added, evidently alluding to himself. "Honor the name of God, preach the kingdom of God, take no part in the affairs of this evil world. Abjure people who tell you otherwise, for Satan speaks through their mouths," he muttered. But Artyom didn't hear anything. He was walking faster and faster, and Brother Timothy couldn't keep up. "Tell me, where shall I be able to find you next time?" he called out from quite a distance, panting and almost lost in the semi-darkness. Artyom remained silent and broke into a run. From behind, out of the darkness, a desperate cry reached him.
"Give the cassock back!"
Artyom ran on ahead, stumbling, unable to see anything in front of him. Several times he fell down, scraping his palms on the concrete floor and skinning his knees, but there was no stopping. He had too clear an image of the black pedestal-mounted machine gun, and now he didn't much believe that the brethren would prefer a meek word to violence if they could catch up to him. He was a step nearer to his goal, being not far away at all from Polis. It was on the same line and only two stations away. The main thing was to go forward, not deviating one step from his route. And then Artyom entered Serpuchovskaya. He didn't pause for a second, only checked his direction and then dived back into the black hole of the tunnel leading ahead. But at this point, something unexpected happened to him. The feeling of terror of the tunnel, which he had already forgotten, came crashing back down upon him, pressing him to the ground, making it difficult for him to walk or think or even breathe. It had seemed to him that by now he had formed some habits, and that after all his wanderings, the horror would leave him and would not dare to bother him again. He had felt neither fear nor alarm when moving from Kitaigorod to Pushkinskaya, nor when riding from Tverskaya to Paveletskaya, nor even as he trudged completely alone from Paveletskaya to Dobryninskaya. But now it had returned. With each step forward, the feeling assailed him more and more. He wanted to turn around immediately and plunge headlong back to the station, where there was at least a little bit of light, and some people, and where his back would not be constantly tickled by the sensation of an intent and malevolent gaze. He had been interacting with people so much that he had stopped feeling what had rushed over him when he first left Alexeyevskaya. But now, once again, he was engulfed by the understanding that the metro was not merely a transportation facility built at a certain point in time, that it was not merely an atomic bomb shelter or home to some tens of thousands of people. Rather, somebody had breathed into it their own mysterious, incomparable life, and it possessed a certain extraordinary kind of reason, which a human being could not fathom, and a consciousness that was alien to him. This sensation was so precise and clear that it seemed to Artyom as if the terror of the tunnel, which people wrongly took to be their ultimate place of refuge, was simply the hostility of this huge being towards the petty creatures who were burrowing into its body. And now it did not want Artyom to go forward. Against his drive to reach the end of his path, to reach his goal, it was pitting its ancient, powerful will, and its resistance was growing with every meter Artyom advanced. Now he was walking through impenetrable darkness, unable to see his own hands, even if he lifted them right up to his face. It was as if he had fallen out of space and out of the currents of time, and it seemed to him as if his body had ceased to exist. It was as if he were not stepping his way through the tunnel, but soaring as a substance of pure reason in an unknown dimension. Artyom could not see the walls receding behind him, so it appeared as if he were standing still, not moving forward a single step, and that the goal of his journey were just as unattainable as it had been 5 or 10 minutes earlier. Yes, his feet were picking their way through the cross-ties, which could have told him that he was changing his spatial position. On the other hand, the signal which advised his brain of each new cross-tie, onto which his foot stepped, was absolutely uniform. Recorded once and for all, now it was repeating to infinity. That also made him doubt the reality of his motion. Was he nearing his goal by moving? Suddenly, he remembered his vision, which provided an answer to the question tormenting him. And then, whether from terror of the unknown, evil, hostile thing that was bearing down on him from behind, or in order to prove to himself that he really was still moving, Artyom rushed ahead with triple the force. And he barely managed to stop, guessing by some sixth sense that an obstacle lay ahead, and miraculously he avoided crashing into it. Carefully probing with his hands along the cold, rusted metal, and then fragments of glass sticking out from rubber gaskets and steel pancakes, which were wheels, he recognized that the mysterious obstacle was a train. This train had been abandoned, apparently. In any case, there was only silence around it. Remembering Mikhail Porfirevich's horrible story, Artyom made no attempt to climb into it, but rather skirted the chain of subway cars, keeping close to the tunnel wall. Getting past the train at last, he breathed a sigh of relief and hurried onward, again breaking into a run. In the darkness this was really difficult, but his legs caught on, and he ran until there appeared ahead, and slightly to one side, the reddish glow of a bonfire. It brought indescribable relief to know that he was in the real world, and that there were real people nearby. It didn't matter how they would relate to him. They could be murderers or thieves, sectarians or revolutionaries, it didn't matter. The main thing was that they were creatures of flesh and blood, like him. He did not doubt for one second that he would be able to find refuge with these people, and to hide from that invisible, huge being which wanted to suffocate him. Or was he seeking refuge from his own deranged mind? Such a strange picture came into view, that he could not say for certain if he had returned to the real world or was still roaming the nooks and crannies of his own subconscious. At Polyanka station, only a single small bonfire was burning, but the absence of any other source of light here made it seem brighter than all the electric lights at Pavelétskaya. Two people were sitting by the bonfire, one with his back turned toward Artyom and one facing him, but neither of them noticed or heard him. It was as if they were separated from him by an invisible wall that cut them off from the outside world. The entire station, insofar as it could be seen by the light of the bonfire, was piled high with an unimaginable variety of junk, the shapes of broken bicycles, automobile tires, and pieces of furniture and equipment could be made out. There was a mountain of rubbish, out of which the people seated by the fire from time to time pulled a stack of newspapers or books and threw them into the flames. There was a plaster bust of somebody or other standing right in front of the fire on the underflooring, and next to it a cat was curled up most comfortably. Not another soul was present. One of the people seated by the fire was telling the other something unhurriedly. Drawing close, Artyom began to pick up what was being said.
"There are rumors going around about the university. Absolutely false, by the way. These are just echoes of the ancient myth of an underground city in the Ramenki district, which was part of Metro 2. But of course you can't refute anything with 100% certainty. Here, in general, you can't say anything with 100% certainty. It's an empire of myths and legend. Metro 2 would have been, of course, the chief myth, the golden one, if more people had known about it. Take, for example, even just the belief in the unseen watchers."
Artyom had approached very close when the person with his back toward him said,
"There's somebody there."
"Of course there is,"
nodded the other.
You may join us,
said the first, addressing Artyom, but without turning his head towards him.
In any event, you can't go any farther.
Why not? Objected Artyom in some agitation.
What, is there somebody there in that tunnel?
No one, of course, the man patiently explained. Who's going to mess around in there?
You can't go there now, anyway, I'm telling you, so sit down.
Thank you.
Artyom took a tentative step forward and sank to the floor across from the bust. They were over 40. One was grey-haired with square glasses and the other was thin with fair hair and a small beard. Both of them were wearing old quilted jackets. They were inhaling smoke through a thin tube rigged up to something like a calabash, from which there issued a head-spinning fragrance.
What's your name?
Asked the fair-haired one.
Artyom,
the young man replied mechanically, busy with studying these strange people.
His name is Artyom,
the fair-haired man said to the other.
Well, that's understood,
he replied.
I am Yevgeny Dmitrievich, and this is Sergei Andreevich, said the fair-haired man.
We don't have to be so formal, do we?
Sergei Andreevich said.
Sergei, as you and I have reached this age, we might as well take advantage of it. It's a question of status and all that. Okay, and what else?
Sergei Andreevich then asked Artyom. The question sounded very odd, as if he were insisting that they continue something that had not ever started, and Artyom was quite perplexed.
So you're Artyom, but so what? Where do you live? Where are you going? What do you believe in? What do you not believe in? Who is to blame, and what is to be done?
Sergei Andreevich explained.
Like it used to be, remember?
Sergei Andreevich said suddenly for no apparent reason.
Oh, yes!
Laughed Yevgeny Dmitrievich.
I live in Vedeyenka, or at least I did live there,
Artyom began reluctantly.
Just like, who put that jackpot on the control panel?
The fair-haired man grinned.
It's nothing left of America,
Sergei Andreevich smirked, taking off his glasses and examining them in the light. Artyom looked warily at them again. Maybe he should just get out of here while the going was good. But what they had been talking about before they noticed him kept him there by the fire.
And what's this about Metro 2, if you'll excuse me? I overheard a little, he admitted.
So, you want to find out the main legend of the Metro?
Sergei Andreevich smiled patronizingly.
Just what is it you want to know?
You were talking about an underground city and about some kind of observers?
Well, Metro 2 was generally a refuge for the gods of the Soviet pantheon during the time of Ragnarok, if the forces of evil were to prevail,
began Yevgeny Dmitrievich, gazing at the ceiling and blowing smoke rings.
According to the legends, under the city whose dead body lies there above us, another metro had been built for the elite. What you see around you is the metro for the common herd. The other one, according to the legends, that's for the shepherds and their dogs. At the very beginning, when the shepherds had not yet lost their power over the herd, they ruled from there. But then their strength gave out, and the sheep ran off. Gates alone were what connected these two worlds, and, if you believe the legends, these were located right where the map is now sliced in two, as if by a blood-red scar. On the Sokolinskaya branch, somewhere behind the Sportivnaya. Later something occurred that closed the entrance to Metro 2 forever. Those who lived here lost any knowledge of what had taken place, and the very existence of Metro 2 became somehow mythical and unreal. But,
he pointed upwards,
despite the fact that the entrance to Metro 2 no longer exists, that does not at all mean that it has ceased to exist. On the contrary, it is all around us. Its tunnels wind around our stations, and its stations could be just a few steps behind our station's walls. These two structures are inseparable. They are like the circulatory system and lymphatic vessels of one organism. And those who believe that the shepherds could not have abandoned their herd to the mercy of fate say that they are present, imperceptibly, in our lives, direct us,
follow our every step, but do not reveal themselves, and do not let their existence be known. And that is the belief in unseen watchers.
The cat, curling up next to the soot-covered bust, raised her head and, opening her enormous, lustrous green eyes, looked at Artyom with a startlingly clear